Shalom Aleichem, everyone. It's Binyamin Haber at National Council Young Israel. I'd like to welcome everyone, and particularly welcome Rebbe, for conference call number 55. Thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you. Question number one. In an email, the email addresses of the 2 and CC carbon copy recipients are visible to all other recipients. The email addresses of recipients in the BCC, blind carbon copy, field are not visible to anyone other than the sender. When the text of the email itself does not indicate that there are BCC recipients, such as the 2 and CC recipients are under the impression that they are the only recipients, could including BCC recipients be usur because of Geneva's Das or some other reason? When the Gemara discusses Geneva's Das, fooling someone, there's a very important caveat. In many cases, the Gemara says, it's Iu da ate anafshe. He's fooling himself. I'm not fooling him. Seems to me it's obvious to anybody that BCC exists. And in any event, the sender can send the same email 5 minutes later to somebody else. So anyone who thinks that he or she is the only recipient because there's no BCC on the screen is fooling himself. Same as a letter. Old-fashioned mail. It's a dear X. I can send exactly the same letter. It's a dear Y. I think it's permissible without a question. Number two. A woman approached me to ask if I would approve of exhuming the body of her grandfather who was buried in the Jewish cemetery where some of the deceased many years ago were put into a niche in the wall along many others, something like a columbarium. Usually it's used for urns of cremated remains. Apparently, in this case, it was used to bury the whole body. The woman is distraught because of the fact that her grandfather is placed very high up on the wall, inaccessible, and she feels that since the man was not observant, they put him in this way. Since the granddaughter is religious, she wants to exhume the body and rebury it in a regular kruah plot and say kaddish for him, something that was not done for him before. It is allowed and or proper to do this. All such matters I refer to Rabbi Zohn. And he says it's a big mitzvah to inter the mace in the ground because kavura should be preferably in the ground, the karka mamish. And, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, in Haram Menuchos, there's a discussion of they bury in komos, which seem to be above the ground. Perhaps that's different, because there's a connection between the above-ground kever and the below-ground kever, surrounded somehow by some of the earth of the city of Yerushalayim. And therefore, even those who are lenient there, which is very questionable, would likely be machmir here. So the proper word for this is probably a crypt, not a columbarium. And it would be a mitzvah to take the body and bury it underground. Kaddish though should not be said. Kaddish only for Yud Beis Chodesh for the first year, as the Gemara explains, because of Mishpat Yud Beis Chodesh. Now that's years later, it's not appropriate to say Kaddish. Question number three. Is it permissible to disinter a family member in New York and reinter in the family plot in California, as all the relatives live out there now? The original kavura was performed in Halacha. Is it a Bizoyan Amase? Or maybe it's a Kavan Amase, as family members will more easily be able to daven at the kever of their family member. Again, as per Rabbi Zohn, it depends what this family plot means. If the family plot is presently occupied by the parents of this individual or the spouse of this individual, then it already has the status of a family plot in practice. And there are poskim who say it's a covenant for a mace to be buried in the family plot, and therefore it would be permissible to move the body from New York to California. If, however, a family plot just means that they purchased plots, but they're right now empty, it would not be appropriate to move this individual from New York to California. Question four. Are eyelash extensions a problem chatzitza for mikveh? My understanding is that they are glued onto the natural eyelashes, and while it is possible to remove them, it is painful or difficult to do so. In Igros Moshe, Yerodech, Elegimel Simon Samar Beis, he talks about what he calls artificial eyelashes, which are presumably the general same thing. Halalacha, not sure if the artificial has, what is it attached to the little bit of the eyelash that's left or to the skin. Doesn't really matter. It's an artificial eyelash. It's made for beauty. That's why people do it. It also has what's called yesh b'mamish. It has, it's discernible as a separate entity. And Moshe writes, there's a machlokes in Simukuf Tzadiches, where we are taught that certain dyes do not constitute a chatzitza, a woman dyes her hair, for example. Why? Is it because it's beautiful? Whatever's beautiful is not a chatzitza. Or is it because it's absorbed into the hair and it's part of the hair? The difference would be if you have only one of the points without the other. Here, a clear example thereof, it is beautiful, as far as Noi works, but it's certainly something which is separate and apart from the body itself, not like dye which is absorbed in the hair. So Ramosha writes that this halakha should depend on this question, that's as far as B'di'evit is concerned. That's a machlokas B'di'evit, the chatchila. It seems that everyone should agree that if it's yesh bo mamish, it has its own mamashis, it's a separate entity, that it should be a problem the chatchila. So it would appear, we spoke about it in a previous shir, the Orcha Shulchan writes in Nuchos Netzila Sedayim against the Mishnah Brura. So it's a dispute. Same thing applies, we spoke then about nail polish, which again, b'di'evid is presumably okay, but the chatchila is questionable. It should be removed. Here it's even more strict. B'di'evid, she has it on, she wants to go to the mikvah, I think it's all right, because you cannot remove it, or it's, or much worse, if you cannot remove it, it's okay. Or perhaps okay. When you say you cannot, it means without causing pain or some kind of complicated way to do so. So I believe, b'di'evid, you may go to the mikveh and if you have that situation right now. But it's better not to, better to remove it. Question 5. Should one be careful to wash his hands before eating foods dipped into liquids? Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Kuf Nun Ches Arachayim Siv Dalet, to be tovel your hands without a bracha. Magen Avraham says when minigas to be megal, not to be tovel at all, based upon Divrei Chamudas, who quotes it from the Tosis. Tosis says that there's no chiyuv to wash your hands b'davar shetibulu b'mashke b'sman hazeh. It was only instituted at a time where we kept the laws of Tumah v'Tahara, which we no longer do, and therefore the whole din does not apply at all. The Divrei Chamudas and Chulin, Perkes Os Mem Aleph, says, look, you can rely on the minig of the Klal Yisrael. Puk Chazir Me'am Adabar. No one does it. No one does it. You can rely on the Antosis, especially for Ashkenazim, who usually follow the Bali Antosis. Despite that, the Mishnah Brewer suggests in Simen Kuf Nun Ches to be Machmor L'Chatchila. I don't think people are following the Mishnah Brewer as a rule. If you want to be Machmor, it's wonderful. It's a beautiful thing to be. To be machmor and wash your hands before people do the mask. If it's too difficult for you, because it's hard to get to a sink, there's no cup, as the case may be, it would be permissible, presumably, to wipe off the fruit, so it now becomes dry. Mr. Brewer writes, the answer is cotton chaf hay. If it's dry, then there's no need to wash your hands, and they quote there in the Dirshu, the Shevet Alevi, Chelek Yud, Simen Tetzvav, it's mut even lechatchila to dry the fruit, so there shouldn't be a problem of Netzila Sedai. Question 6. What Torah should be recited on pizza to make a difference how much pizza is eaten? There's a quote in there from Moshe Feinstein that one slice of Misonis, this is psak, still hold true, now that many people eat pizza as a meal. So the question, Shela Schachem is Chasi Tshuva. Now it became an Iker Suda, and therefore the bracha should be hamotzi, irrespective of whether the dough is made with water or with fruit juices, doesn't matter. The general principle is whatever is made is the main part of a meal, meant for that purpose, has a bracha of hamotzi. That's the psak, which I think many post-gamble with respect to pizza and the dirish, they quote that Rav Shlomo Zalman held that way, Rav Scheinberg held that way, Rav Tzvi and Abba Shaul held that way, although Rav Eliyashiv was quoted saying the reverse. It's only mezonos if you're using fruit juices. If you look at Mishnah Brewer there, Kufasa Meches, if caught in Sadi Dal, you got an impression, whatever's normally eaten to fill you up, it's like you have a cheese sandwich. The pizza's basically a cheese sandwich. The bracha zamotzi, that seems to be the psak, la halacha la maisa, even though not everyone agrees. Number 7. A group of people in my shul want to start wearing tchelis and encourage others to do so. Since not all the men even wear tzitzis at all, I see this as a great way to bring more awareness to tzitzis in general. It takes a long time to tie many sets of tchelis, tzitzis, and it is also very tedious. One of the balabatim has already purchased many sets of strings. Can we ask a woman in our community to start the tzitzis? There are two women who are both very meticulous and also very tzanua, and would do a better job than the men into tying and allow the men more time for learning rather than tying tzitzis. Well, let's discuss the din as is found in the Shulchan Aruch. We know that in Siman Yud Dalet Sefalaf in Aruch Chaim, the Mechaber says it's okay and the Ramah says it's not okay. Why is it not okay? Well, some say it's even not okay with the Evid. Tabel B'nei Yisrael from Atla Masulim Tzitzis. B'nei Yisrael and not B'nos Yisrael, some say. Rabbi Natam says, she's not B'levisha, she's not B'asiya. Women are putter from wearing tzitzis, so they're disqualified from making tzitzis. So therefore, it seems to me that they should ask the women, should not ask the women to tie the tzitzis, which is called tliya, as the Mishnah Berurah calls in Sifkot and Gimel. B'di'evet, it's okay, but the Chatzchila should not be asked. I have to comment, as I've done in the past, the whole idea of Tchelis is not universally accepted at all. I think it's better maybe to do without Tchelis. But that wasn't the question asked over here, so referring to previous year where it was discussed. 8, is it permissible to play in an online or live poker tournament occasionally as a recreational activity? In my opinion, it's absolutely prohibited. And the reason is, even if you're doing it without money at all, it can be habit forming. Once it's habit forming, people end up gambling for playing poker. It's going to destroy their lives completely. We know people who start becoming addicted to gambling and destroy their marriages, destroy their livelihoods, destroy their relationship with their children, destroy their lives, they're certainly their spiritual lives. It seems to me that, you know, if the question is raised about any Iser Gezel involved in gambling, which is a possibility, we should apply the principle of Chamira Sakanta Me'isura. The danger of destroying your life is much more serious than any potential violation of Gzela, and therefore, in my view, it should never be done. Question 9. The best eitzah regarding the date of Kisuba when the Chosin's Tish is planned less than an hour before Shkia and the Chuppah is scheduled for right after Shkia, assuming it's a basically on-time wedding. Yes, it's true. This does happen. It seems to me the best eitzah in such a case is to wait till after Shkia. As soon as the sun sets, the haggishah should be picked up. The ksuba should be signed, the nighttime date. You see, mu'uchar, technically speaking, is mutter, if it's post-dated, but it's not nice to do mu'uchar. But once you wait till after the sun sets and the ban hashmashes, you have no choice but to write the later date, because the old date might be a sort of muktam, predating. So once you pass the sunset, the proper time to write the document date is the later date, which is exactly what should be done. Truth is, an hour after the Kabbalah's Panim is called for, generally speaking, they haven't gone to the Chuppah yet. As a matter of fact, in most cases, at least in this country, many, if not most, they haven't even gone to the Bedekin yet. So if that's the case, there's no problem. Just do it right then and there, the Tachosn Tish, before they go to Bedekin. If they went to the Bedekin earlier, which is possible, it's advisable whenever it can be done, and they want the Sanduk Ksuba then, and you want to have the later date on it for the reasons we just said, so there's no problem. There's no halacha. The Ksuba has to be signed in front of the 100 people at the Tish. It can be signed in private. One of my son's weddings, he wanted a particular aide to sign on the Ksuba. The aide wasn't there yet. So we said, okay, we'll go to the Bedekin without the aide. The aide came a little bit later, and we signed the Ksuba, the Kabbalah of Kenyan, and the signature of the Ksuba, in a private room where the chosen waits before the Ksuba. That's the best Eitzah that seems to be Yotzeh L'chol Hadeis. According to most authorities, the other option exists, which is to sign the Ksuba earlier, before the sun sets, with the earlier date. And it's not considered to be a shtar muktam, because the obligation is entered into at the moment that the handkerchief is picked up. This seems to be the accepted view. Rav Moshe is in a tshuva, and there's Dibros Moshe of a Metzia, that he thinks it wouldn't work, because you cannot obligate yourself to chiyuv ksuba before you're married. So in the olden days, there was a period between Eris and Nesuin, between the first stage of marriage and the full marriage, and in that period of time, in that period of time, they would write a ksuba, and that could be valid even before the Nisuan, but only after the Eris. But today, when we no longer do that, Eris and Nisuan together, Rav Moshe Paskins, he cannot be mischayev and a ksuba before the Eris. But again, it seems to me that the majority view is not in accordance with Rav Moshe. So the first eighth I gave you was the best because it encompasses all opinions. But if that's not workable for whatever reason, so you can rely on the majority of the poskim. Question number 10. It's the custom in our shul that a bar mitzvah boy lays some of the aliyahs of his parasha on the Shabbos of his bar mitzvah. Unfortunately, some of the boys, even after copious practice, make an inordinate amount of mistakes in the laying that's almost impossible to correct everyone. The setup of our shul is the gabbai is by the kriya with the bar mitzvah boy reading and the teacher next to him. The rabbi is sitting higher up near the Aron Kodesh, and for the rabbi to continually correct mistakes from farther away can become embarrassing. What suggestions do you have? How to practically deal with these situations. Well, the simple answer is, the rabbi should get off his chair and stand next to the bar mitzvah boy. And if he has to make a correction, he'll make it quietly, quickly, so there'll be much less embarrassment. Whatever the other people were doing, the rabbi could do himself. That's a simple answer. Remember, not every mistake is worthy of going back. People don't understand the nuances. Having the rabbi decide is always a proper way to decide, and especially in a case such as this. On the other hand, I think every shul should have an appointee to go over every bar mitzvah bracha's laning. And if you find that the bar mitzvah bracha is not up to par, and this young man, no matter how much you try, is never going to be able to get through the laning without numerous mistakes, the best advice for everybody's welfare is he shouldn't lane that much. Let him lane only the Haftorah. With Haftorah, you can have dots. And the trouble is in front of you, it's much, much easier than reading from the Sefer Torah. If he wants to just lay in a little bit, let him lay maybe the Mafter as well, which used to be the minig in many places. It's much better to let him lay a small amount properly than to lay in much more than that with an inordinate number of mistakes. Okay. Again, the Mafter is such a short thing, 3 psukim, 4 psukim. Hopefully he can get everything straight there. And even if not, Mafter is not as strict as your first 7, because 7 already read the whole parsha, and that's the magic number of 7 for Shabbos. So there's more room to really need for the Mafter, and Haftorah is much easier as well. Okay, number 10. Brach on Talos and Sulam regarding Mishayakir. Do's and don'ts of Los HaShachar. In Detroit and Seattle. Seattle is too far. Well, let's take Detroit, which I think is larger from community. This Thursday, means tomorrow, Alos, 72 minutes before Nait, is 6:43 a.m., and there are minyanim that start at 6:40 a.m. What do you do? So the first thing you do is start 3 minutes late. Not terrible. as of Motzei Shabbos and move the clock. But to discuss the real halachas, let's take a look. Let's talk about New York City. It's easier for me to discuss New York City than Detroit. Well, at the end, we'll try to extrapolate. Tomorrow, I believe the night's sunrise is 7:27 in New York City. Alos HaShachar, obviously, if you're counting 72, would be 6:15. But there are many who calculate 72 extrapolated based upon the angle of the sun beneath the earth. And that's how I think it's proper to Paskin. And that would come out not 6:15, but 6:04. So 11 minutes earlier. 11 minutes earlier. So that's as far as Alos HaShachar is concerned. So that's one. As far as Mishayakir, if you look in the Luach, the standard Luach, they have two Zmanah for Mishayakir. They're 10.2 degrees beneath the horizon, or 11, which would translate the more lenient one, 11, would be 6:32, and the stricter one would be 6:37, which of course could be pretty late. That's based on 10.2 or 11 degrees beneath the horizon. However, if you look in the Kaf HaChaim and others, they say that the shear is an hour before Neitz HaChama, which in Yerushalayim in the spring is 12.9 degrees beneath sun beneath the horizon, which would come out to, in New York, 6:22. It would be 10 to 15 minutes earlier than the printed Luach, 65 minutes before Neitz HaChama. So in Detroit, the sun rises at 7:55, because 6:43 is 72 minutes before, by higher arithmetic. So Mashiach will be approximately 6:50. Now, you have a 6:40 minyan. Put the talis and tefillin on at the beginning without a bracha. And you can make a bracha one of two ways. Either after between Yishtabach and Kaddish, where there's a certain leniency to interrupt for certain things. Truth is, if you ask me, it's better to wait until the end of davening. You know, maybe before the second Ashrei, you know, that's when the bracha and the talis and tefillin should be made, even though ideally we make brachas earlier, because there are different opinions as what's Mishayakar. I gave you next to the most lenient opinion, which is found in the Kaf HaChaim and other sources, the Gesher HaChaim, that's an hour before Shkia in Yerushalayim, which is 12.9. But there were people who are much stricter. Rav Yashiv is quoted in the Deir Shu, I believe, that it's a half an hour. This is in Siman Yud Ches, footnote 12. A half an hour. Rav Moshe says 35 minutes. And Rav Shlomo Zalman, they quote Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, say 40 or maybe less than 50 minutes. On the other hand, if you want to go the other way, the Bialocha and Siman Nun Ches, quotes the Prima Gaonim, it's only 6 minutes after Alos HaShachar, which would make it more than 70 minutes if you follow the angle's opinion. There are numerous opinions, so therefore, if the people are in a rush, they should put it on right away, as soon as it's Alos HaShachar, not make a bracha. Make a bracha, ideally, before the Ashrei at the end of davening, give a bang, and everyone makes a bracha then. That's what was done in my shul when I first came, even before I came, back in 1973 and 4, there was a all-year daylight savings time to contend with the oil shortage, and I meant the cents rose in New York at 8:20 January 1st and thereafter. Big problem. So we did exactly this. We relied on putting on the talis and tefillin without a bracha at Alos HaShachar and making the bracha before the Ashrei end of davening. Okay, number 11. What is the Torah's perspective on child support and custody of children? Is there a source for child support? How much is one obligated to pay? What are the determining factors? Regarding custody, who should get custody in an ideal world? What factors are used in determining who should get custody and how much, weekends and weekdays, etc.? My understanding is that in New York State, children minors are considered wards of the state, and therefore the judge will not consider Bezdin's custody agreement unless it also fits under the New York State laws. But I'd like to know what the din is anyway. The din is anyway, any Bezdin should make sure that's going to be confirmed by the New York State Court. Otherwise, you're spinning your wheels for nothing. Talking about support first. So a father is obligated to support his children. So din mefurish in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, obligated. How much until what age? It says in the Shulchan Aruch till the age of six, the ripe old age of six. After six, the child is independent. The chief rabbi in Israel 70 years ago moved us to 15. They weren't independent until 15. Today, some have suggested 18 or 21. It's appropriate to go with those numbers. Until then, the father must support his children. But how can he do that? Who are we to change the law of the Gemara? So the prevailing opinion is, you're right, it's hard for us to change the number six, which is found in Shas. But the very least, we can impose it as an obligation of tzedakah, involuntary tzedakah. Tzedakah towards one's closest of relatives is mandated and compelled, if you will, by the Bezdin. So therefore, it sounds like it's a much more lenient obligation if we view it as tzedakah, as opposed to, if we would view it as an absolute law of tzedakah k'suba. But it turns out that it's possible the reverse is true. Because if it's tznoeg suba proper, the question becomes, what's the nature of the obligation? The nature of the obligation. That if the child support obligation is a part of the obligation to feed your wife, then it goes to the highest standard. The Gemara says, only mo bene redesimo, that the husband has support his wife at the higher of the following two standards, either his standard of living or her standard of living growing up. She shouldn't go down when she gets married. Well, here too, we have a principle when it comes to tzedakah, de'machsora sheyechsa lo, that if he's a wealthy man, you have to give him whatever wealthy man needs, even a horse to travel on, and a servant to go in front of him, whatever he's accustomed to, up to a point. And therefore, in our situation of child support, if you're going with tnai k'suba, the likelihood is that you can get away with very little. Because whether you have to give the children a lot or a little depends on whether it's an independent obligation, then we find no source to give more than basic necessities, or it's a part of the wife's obligation. And if the wife you're supposed to take care of at her level, so too the children at their level. But the problem is, once they're divorced, it's difficult to view the obligation to the children as part of the obligation to the wife. There is an obligation to the wife. So therefore, you're back to an independent obligation with a much lower rate, according to some. Once you put in the category of mandated tzedakah, then we have the principle of de'emal k'sor she'yachsalo, which is the higher amount. And that's what the Bezdin that I deal with, they give the higher amount, try to give an estimate of how much it costs to live at the standard of living that they knew before the parents split up. That's much, much more than New York State requires. So they're not going to overturn it on that basis. Okay. Well, let's go further. Again, that machlokas, the Russian demand is found in the Chalkos Mechokek, Simon Ayin Aleph, Sivkotin Aleph. As far as custody, so you don't find this anywhere with Farish and Shas, but the consensus of the Poskim today is to do whatever is in the best interest of the children, which happens to be the same standard as New York State has. So you're supposed to figure out what's in the best interest of the children and come up with a sum which is appropriate given that estimate. Now, New York State has the same exact criterion, except for the idea of religion. In other words, in New York State, they're not taking into account that one of the parents is from, another parent is not from. They disregard that. But other than that, they would accept our criteria, and they will not overturn our decisions. And all our decisions in our beds, and have, to my knowledge, never been overturned, because we have state-of-the-art. We have everything is taped. We have a psychologist. Often we've used the service of Dr. Pelkovitz, who's the top psychologist, better than any of the psychologists they can come up with in secular court. He's not about to overturn something which he signs off on. So that's the way it should be. It should be done. Question number 12. If an employer is ordered by New York State to withhold money from someone's salary to pay child support, is the employer obligated to do so according to Torah law? Can the employee take the employer to Bezdin if he feels that the state is withholding too much money or money he cannot afford to pay, assuming he legitimately can't afford it? The answer is the employer is bound by the laws of New York State. Perhaps we could apply the principle of Dina de Malchus Adina. Even if not, if he doesn't comply with the laws of New York State, he stands to lose his license or whatever he has in order to work. And therefore, he has no choice but to follow New York State's law to withhold money, which is, they call it, garnished, to pay child support. He has no choice but to do it. And as a result, there's no din Torah possible. He can't go to a bezin because he did it what he had to do. Presumably, it would be even the right thing to do, but that's not the last word. He has no choice. He has to do it. I do not believe there's any din Torah that can be had. Question 13. How many people need to wash at the Sheva Brachos in order to be able to recite the Sheva Brachos? Many opinions we pass, and the answer is 7. The same as the 7 for benching, Ruba de Minkara, Sota of the Sheva Brachos. B. Can one who has not washed recite one of the Sheva Brachos? The answer we accept is yes, although the others disagree. C. Sheva Brachos at Shalosh Shuras after Shkia. When should the Hagefen be recited? And when should the Chasam Kala and the one who led the benching drink, if he should drink at all? The answer, he should not drink at all. The meaning is, again, many opinions, only the Chasam and the Kala drink from the kos of Sheva Brachos. The Chasam drink first, puts it down, then the Kala drinks. No one else drinks. Usually at Shalosh Shudas, the cup is held for Avdala upstairs in Shul. That should happen in this case again. Save the kos of Birchas Mazon for Avdala. And the kos of Sheva Brachos should be consumed by the chosn and the kala in that order. D. Someone's getting married on Monday night after Seis. Should Tachna be recited on Monday at Shacharis at Mincha? Answer to those questions, to both questions, is no. Although we're machmir that Sheva Brachos would end in such a case One minute here. Monday night after Seis is Tuesday. Then there's nothing to discuss. Of course you would not say Tachton Monday at Shacharis at Mincha, because it's only the 7th day. The question is, maybe that's what the person meant to ask, although it's not phrased properly, what happens if the 7th day passed, but 7 full days have not passed? That's the shaila. So someone gets married, gets married by day. So the day is over, he's married on by day. The day is over in a few hours. So therefore, as far as Sheva Brachos are concerned, if you get married on Sunday, so the last Sheva Brachos is Shabbos. You have to finish benching before Shkia to be Paskin La'alocha. Gets married on Monday. The last Sheva Brachos has to be held on Sunday before Shkia. Fine, that's very nice. What will happen? The person who gets married on Monday late afternoon. So the 7th day is Sunday. After Sunday at Shkia, you can no longer say Sheva Brachos. He comes to Shul Monday morning, and everyone's waiting not to say Tachlan. Uh-huh. So someone says, well, but the Sheva Brachos are over. Can't make Sheva Brachos any longer. because Monday is day one, Sunday is day seven. The psak is you do not say tachnon. The reason is it's a suffik. So suffik brachas lahakel, but suffik tachnon is also lahakel. You wouldn't make a bracha. We're not sure if a bracha should be made when it's beyond the seventh day, but less than 24/7 after the wedding. But as far as tachlin is concerned, we say suffik tachlin hakel. You wouldn't say tachlin either. So you have that psak. Again, I believe that question is being asked, although the words of the question don't seem to read that way. Okay. Again, same would apply to mincha. If you got married at 5 o'clock, and mincha is at 3 o'clock, so you would omit tachlin there as well. 14. Is it permissible to carry a gun, pepper spray, a whistle, or a small pin-type alarm on Shabbos for an individual who feels that he needs to carry this for self-defense? Wow. We live in difficult times. I'm talking from New York City. I'm talking from the borough of Manhattan, right up the West Side Highway from the terrible incident, terror attack of yesterday. So this is a special significance. So, you know, a gun, it's a big fight in America, gun licensing. It seems that statistics that I've read have indicated, and you should check it out, that carrying a gun statistically may be more dangerous than not carrying a gun. Due to a combination of accidents and someone who is attacking you, he takes a gun and can shoot you. So therefore, if that's the case, we should stay away from guns, not only on Shabbos, but during the week as well. Again, people may have different statistics, but that's what I understand. The others, which are purely defensive in nature, pepper spray, whistle, or alarm, are obviously mutter during the week. On Shabbos, it seems to me, if there's an Eruv, it should be okay, even though the Muktzah Shaila is probably defined as a Kli Shemalacht or the Iser, which we paskin is mutter the Torah Kufa Mekomo, here's the Torah Kufa. If there's no Eruv, it's a serious problem. There are those who are make or certain situations to carry with a shinui. If it's dangerous, you know, the apparent danger is not here. Even after the terrible event of yesterday, it's just an aberration. In this country, I believe that we're fairly safe. We walk around on Shabbos. So I would not be quick to allow it in a place where there's no Eruv. 15. A couple has rented an apartment whose previous tenant is a Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kasher, is a former tenant, shared with the new tenant, which counts as meat, dairy, Kasher the oven, when they moved in. As the Rav, I am familiar with the former tenant and the struggles they had with the landlord not paying the rent, even though we rely on Echanem Neman. Should I guide them to kasher their kitchen? Maybe the rabbi is afraid that the person who didn't pay the rent lacks in his honesty and therefore is not honest when he's saying that the food was kosher and everything was kept separate there and meat. In my opinion, there's no need to kasher. In a busy evidence, as an Eino Ben Yomo, nothing becomes treif. I do not believe you have to worry that something became treif over here. There's Gzeira, Eina Ben Yomo, Otto Ben Yomo, which is the reason we have to kasher after 24 hours, is only if you know for sure that it's not kosher. Once a psak from Rav David Feinstein Shalita, that they kept kosher even on a minimal, even on a conservative Judaism basis, there may not be an obligation to kasher after 24 hours. I see no reason to kasher in this case. 16. Can one wear a hospital-issued ID bracelet given to parents or spouses of a patient on Shabbos where there is no Eruv? This is a very difficult question. One should look it up in the Sefer Orchos Shabbos, Chela Gimel, page Reish Tes, a whole page on this issue. They cite a Mishnah Brura, Simon Shin Aleph, Sivkot and Pe Gimel, that if it's Urche Kol HaShavua, Lotzespo, all week ago that way, it's Mutter. Why? It's Kegufo, it's like the body itself. However, a distinction can be made. There, the case is an Eved who has a Chosam. There's some kind of a servant, and he's some kind of something which is wrapped around him to indicate that he belongs to a particular master. That's their Bekvias all year, not just for this week. as opposed to our case. The most common case we have is if a, let's talk about the positive case, a man is blessed with a child, and they're very careful in the nurseries these days. So you have to have that bracelet around your wrist, but it's going to come off in 3 days when the child is discharged. Not so simple, they argue in the Orchel Shabbos, to extrapolate from the case of the Mishnah Berurah Shinal Tegimel to this case. And then they quote from Shmuel Orbach that there's a Rashi in Shabbos Nun Dalet Amud Beis, which is cited in Siman Shin Hei Sivkotin Mem Tes, that in certain cases you're not permitted to allow your animals, even your chickens, to walk around in a case where there's no Eruv, with a sign of who to whom the chicken belongs. According to Rashi there in Shabbos and Dalman Beis, the Easter is maybe it's going to fall off and you will carry it in the street. That's the case. It would not apply in our situation. It's not falling off so fast. It's clipped on. It's hard to get off. You usually have to cut it with the scissors. So it would be permissible. However, Rambam and Pirush HaMishnayos there seems to say it's a masli. It's the Easter of carrying as such, not lest you may it may fall off, you may carry it. It is carrying, even though it's identifying who the owner is. In our case, who the person is, the father of the baby or the whatever the patient, etc. So it's a shaila which is unresolved. It seems to me, therefore, in a pinch, if this is a disputed issue between the Rashi and the Rambam. And we assume nowadays we no longer have a Rosh Hashanah Daraisa, otherwise our Erevin wouldn't work, Bipshuto. So if it's a cold, the Carmelis, then we say it's Tzveka D'Rabbana L'Kula. So again, if there's no alternative, it can be left on. In some cases, they'll let you check it at the security, and they'll trust you that it's you, even though it's not literally clipped on your wrist, but that's not to be taken for granted. 17. How many times can one use and reuse aluminum pans without toiling them? The answer is as follows. We assume, la halacha, that these disposable pans are disposable. They're meant to be thrown out right away. Therefore, when you buy it from a guy, it's not considered to be a kli, because a kli is something which has more permanence. This is meant to be thrown out. When you bought it from the non-Jewish manufacturer, it was not called a kli. And it's not called a kli. There's no chiva tefilas kelim. Later on, when you decide to use it and reuse it and reuse it and reuse it, maybe it's called a clean now, but now it's in Jewish hands. There's no chiyuv of tefillah. If that's the case, you can use it 1,000 times, there would still be no obligation of tefillah whatsoever, according to that opinion. Question number 18. In a non-Arab community, can one wear a red bendled bracelet on Shabbos? In general, is there any issue wearing a red bendled bracelet even during the week? The Reuter Bendel has no real source in Halacha or even in Kabbalah. It's not an early custom. It started sometime, I think, in the 1900s. And some say it's actually a violation of what's called Darkei Hamori, it's suspicion. Although others say it's based on the Kabbalistic, it kicks away the Ayin Hara. It seems to me it's preferred to stay away from the Reuter Bendel 7 days a week. Interestingly, according to those who wear the Reuter Bendel, despite my protestations, they must hold it as effective in warding off an Ayin Hara. Then, if according to their understanding, it may be mutter on Shabbos too, like a Kameya, in Siman Shin Gimel, Sif Tezvav, Mishnah Berurah Sivkot Lamates. Yes, it's true, you need a Smachi Gavra, Smachi Kameya, but some poskim say that if you and your mind are convinced that it's helpful, that there is some leniency. And this person who wears the Reuter Bendel thinks it saves him from an Ayin Hara. So, again, I don't think it's true. You should better not wear it. But if you think it's true when you're wearing it, there's room to be lenient, even on Shabbos, without an Eruv. Finally, 19, what bracha does one make on dried fruit? The accepted opinions you make of Bari Priya Eitz. The fact that the fruit is dried, it has not lost its Iker bracha. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe, very much. We hope we can call upon you again in the near future, and have a good night. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.